The ABC Radio Network presents ABC Correspondents at Home, a roundtable discussion with the newsmen who cover the news capitals of the world, looking at what could happen in the new year in light of what has transpired in the year just ending. From our studios here in New York, you'll hear Lou Cioffi, ABC's chief European correspondent, Bill Sheehan, our London bureau chief, Russell Jones, who makes his headquarters in Berlin, Sidney Lazard, ABC's man in Rome, Sam Jaffe, who has the tenuous job of reporting from Moscow, and our man on the firing line in South Vietnam, Charles P. Arnold. Anchorman is Don Gardner, heard daily on ABC's major morning news roundup, News Around the World. ABC News Team represents many long years of arduous reporting from some of the world's hottest trouble spots. Now, to open our discussion, here is Don Gardner.
If I had to pick one spot more important than another in news, it'd be very difficult, so let's turn to the ABC men who cover the news in the world capitals and let them relate it firsthand. Perhaps using alphabet, let's start with Charles P. Arnold from our Saigon office. Charlie, is there any real hope for a solution to this Vietnamese problem politically in Saigon?
Don, there's no easy solution to the South Vietnam problem. But there are two things we must have in order to get a solution. First, you must have a stable government and effective leadership. Secondly, you must have popular support behind the war effort. And both of these things, so far, we've been unable to achieve. The leadership has proved inept and unstable, and we have more weapons, more soldiers, more economic aid on our side than the communists have. But they've been able to have one thing, been able to achieve one thing, and that's motivation of the people, which we have not been able to do. We've not been able to make a dent in the people whatsoever. For example, a year ago, it's estimated that the Viet Cong controlled about one-third of the country. Today, they control nearly 80% of the entire country. I think this is a war that could drag on, as one general told me before I left Saigon, for 2,000 years. On the other hand, there could be an explosion and blow us right out of South Vietnam tomorrow or the day after.
Well, what about the threat of the Chinese communists in connection with Vietnam?
I think this is very serious. In fact, I think the year 1965 is going to find us more and more on a direct collision course with Red China. The Chinese, as you know, have exploded the nuclear bomb, have become a member of the bomb club. They're pressing the guerrilla war in South Vietnam, despite our warnings, many warnings from our State Department and officials to leave their neighbors alone. On their side, they have delivered, I think, something like 530 serious warnings to us. Their tremendous hatred and contempt for us continues and grows. Now they're putting into effect a pincers movement around us and our allies in Southeast Asia, concentrating on Cambodia, and even more important, Indonesia. The Red Chinese have an army of 2.5 million men, and as they showed in Korea, they're ready to squander these men. And even though they do not have the power to deliver the bomb, at this point, I think that war with Red China is a very real and serious threat.
Well, who do you think will get into that war with Red China? Who will break the thing wide open?
Well, just where it will come and how it will come is a question. But it will certainly be a confrontation between the United States and Red China.
Now, maybe Sam Jaffe, who covers the ABC Bureau in Moscow, would have some observations on that.
Well, I don't think it will come, Don. I just don't see it from the Russian viewpoint. I think the Soviets would have to back the Chinese, and they're not ready to do this at this stage of the game. They've got their own troubles with the Chinese. They're not going to supply them militarily. They're not going to give them economic aid, and I don't believe there's any moral support involved either.
Sam, one of the biggest stories that you covered this past year in Moscow was the step down of Nikita Khrushchev. How did you get a lead on that story?
On the telephone, the way you get most leads. I had a call, and a chap said to me, a friend of yours is out. I said, a friend of mine? He said, yes, someone you've just traveled with recently. And I couldn't believe it. I was shocked, like turned out everybody else. He said, yes, he is out. And I said, out of one or both jobs? He said, out of both jobs. That was the way the story broke. I later tried to check it out with other sources and found one person that I was able to get at home who said, yes, it was Khrushchev who was out.
All right, what are your observations on the two men that stepped in, Brezhnev and Kosygin?
Both of them very capable, very businesslike men, especially Kosygin, the new head of the Soviet government. I think that both of these fellows are going to move very, very slowly. They have a lot of work to do cleaning up the mess Khrushchev left behind, primarily an economic mess. And I think in relation to foreign affairs, they're going to bide their time. They're going to think things over very seriously. There will be no rash decisions or judgments, as happened during the Khrushchev era. I think it's going to be a stable regime.
Is news easy to dig up in Moscow?
No, not very easy. Basically, it's what we get out of the newspapers, Pravda, the newspaper of the Communist Party, Izvestia, the Soviet government paper, and after you've been there a while, from your sources. Sources, there are some Soviet sources. There are sources in the foreign embassies, including the satellite embassies, and a few sources or contacts in the Western embassies.
So now, you have to dig for your news. One of our other ABC bureaus comes by it much more handily, London, ABC's Bill Sheehan. What was the big story in London last year, Bill?
The election of the first Labour government in 13 years would have to be the answer to that, Don. There's no question about the government's election and its growing pains in getting started with the big stories in 64.
How's this going to relate to U.S. government, the Labour government in Britain?
Well, the British and American governments have worked in very close partnership since the days of Churchill and Roosevelt, and any time there's a change in government in either country, it affects the other country. I think that the Labour government, although it doesn't like the term special relationship that came into usage in the last few years, the post-Suez years, it does want a close working relationship with the United States government and has shown signs that it intends to operate that way.
Now, the new Labour government in Britain has some of its own ideas concerning a proposed U.S.-proposed NATO nuclear fleet. What are these British proposals? How are they made up?
Well, there isn't any enthusiasm in Europe anywhere that I can see for the American proposal for a multilateral, mixed-manned nuclear fleet. And the British have come up with a plan which they think will satisfy the United States in one respect, satisfy the Germans in one respect, and come up with a force that will be effective under NATO. It would be air, sea, and ground unit, which would consist of contributions from many different countries. The mixed manned element would be a ground installation of missiles to which different countries could contribute manpower. I don't think that's going to come into being in 1965, however.
Now, Bill, you say that there isn't too much enthusiasm in Europe. I think you mean on a widespread way, but I think Russell Jones from our Berlin office can possibly give us the West German viewpoint of the mixed NATO nuclear force.
I don't think there's any enthusiasm in Germany about this. The Germans have, in effect, abdicated their foreign policy, their policy of defense, turned it over to the United States, and they go along with us on almost anything. They will go along with the so-called MLF, the multilateral force, if we insist and if we also manage to persuade our other allies. But I don't think the Germans are going to take the initiative. They'd be just as happy as anyone else if these three letters, MLF, were completely forgotten about.
Now, one of the most ardent objectors to the NATO nuclear idea is French President de Gaulle. Luciaffi in Paris, your observations.
Well, the general has always said that Europe doesn't want it. He has always said that it's not going to work. The general will have nothing to do with an MLF of any kind. He, as a matter of fact, his policy is don't give nuclear control to anyone. He says the United States would be stupid to give control of its nuclear weapons to another nation, and he says France is not going to give its control of its weapons to any other nation until there is a United States of Europe. At that point, of course, the nuclear weapons belong to all of Europe.
Now, de Gaulle seems to be following what I would call a third-man theme. He wants to establish France as being a third great power in the world. Do you think that Mr. de Gaulle can succeed?
As France is a third great power? No, I don't think France can be a third great power. I think what de Gaulle, at least what de Gaulle says he wants, is for Europe to be a third great power. I know a lot of people have the conception that General de Gaulle is against the common market. General de Gaulle is against political union. The only thing de Gaulle has ever said against any of these things is that they must be done in stages. As a matter of fact, this common market, which is a very complicated situation, if it wasn't for de Gaulle in the last 2 years, they would never have gotten an agricultural agreement, and Europe would not be as close together as it is now. What he wants is eventual political union of Europe. And he says this political union, this United States of Europe, eventually will be a third force automatically. Back in 1945, General de Gaulle, in speaking to the National Assembly, mentioned France and Europe as being not a pawn, but a bridge between East and West, between Moscow and Washington.
Now, another important European capital is Rome. Sidney Lazard covers the ABC bureau there. Sidney, why does it take so long to pick an Italian president?
Well, for a very simple reason, Don. That is, there are too many candidates and too many parties. Politics in Rome is still pretty wild and woolly. There are no allegiances that are worth anything that last any length of time. Every man would like to see his man in office. The reason each party and each faction within each party wants its man in office is because the president in Italy has the power to select a new government once the government falls. That's about his only power, but he does have that discretion. Governments fall in Italy every year, or they have every year just about since the war. And so when politicians elect a president, they're not so much electing the president, but they're electing the man who can pick the next government. And therefore, they'd like to see their man in the office so that they could get one of their men in as prime minister next time around.
Well, how did the Communist Party get to be so strong in Italy?
Well, the Communist Party in Italy, it is said, and I am not absolutely certain if this is the case, but I have no evidence to the contrary. The Communist Party is supposedly a party of protest. People vote communist who are against whatever the regime of the day is. It doesn't mean that they're communist, doesn't mean that they know anything about Marxism, Leninism, or even socialism. But if they're against the order of the day, they will vote communist simply to register their protest.
Lou, you had an observation.
Yeah, this is also true in France. Your Communist Party membership itself, like in Italy, is not terribly high. It's their vote-getting capacity. And Frenchmen, I think, like Italians, vote communist to protest. They see no other party that pleases them, no other program that pleases them, so they vote communist simply to protest.
Well, Don, in Italy, you have the peculiar phenomenon of a steady increase in Communist Party voters. At the same time, a decrease in actual Communist Party membership and in Communist Party control of key unions, meaning that the hardcore members are diminishing while the mass of the people who have gripes are increasing and registering these gripes through the Communist Party.
Don, this is a point I'd like to bring out here, that in my part of the world, the Viet Cong, of course, are the communists, but they never, in their propaganda, ever mention the word communist. And it's all based on anti-colonialism, and of course, we Americans are played up as the new colonialists replacing the French. But in talking with captured Viet Cong prisoners and others, never do they ever mention the word communist, as against in Europe, where people are members of the Communist Party.
They don't even like to be called Viet Cong, because Cong is communist.
Well, Viet Cong is just a slogan, sort of a term for Vietnam communist.
Yep.
Interestingly enough, in the seat of communism, Soviet Union, and in Red China, the Communist Party is in minority. The people vote, they can only vote for one regime, but the party itself, the number of communists, is in the minority.
Well, Sam Jaffe, do the people in the Kremlin actually give dictums to the communists in other European lands and other world lands?
They try nowadays. I think certainly that if there was a showdown, if there was a war, the satellites today would join in with Moscow. There's no question about that. But what's happened in the last, I guess, 5 years has been a definite parting of the ways, that the satellites now feel more independent. They're rather flexing their muscles, and especially in the case of Romania. And I'm talking about actual satellites, not Yugoslavia. And they're seeking more ties with the West. But, as I say again, if it came to a showdown, the satellites would be on the side of Moscow, without question.
Now, that's about the satellites. How about the communists in other countries that are not satellites of Moscow? What do you think the Communist Party's reaction would be there if the war should break out?
Well, that's a good question. I think in Italy, Sid, they wouldn't back Moscow.
Absolutely right. The line of the party in Italy, and as you know, Don, Italy's party is the biggest in the non-communist world. The line has been peaceful coexistence. And when Khrushchev was put out of his job, the first thing the communist leadership in Italy did was to affirm that it continued to back his policies of peaceful coexistence and insisted that the new Soviet government retain those policies. And I feel had the new Soviet government made any effort to veer further to the right or restore Stalinism or a hard policy, it would have met very serious objections and perhaps even a break with the communist parties in Europe.
Now, yes, Charles.
I think this is a very interesting point that's been brought up here, and that is during the past year or 2 years, the weight of the communist world outside of the Soviet Union and Red China that has switched from the Soviet Union toward Red China. Indonesia, for example, has 2 million Communist Party members. And the Indonesian, it's the largest outside the communist bloc. The Indonesian party is now tying itself very closely to Peking. Even in India, despite the Red Chinese attack on India in 62, many Indian communists are tying themselves to Peking. So I think this is a big question. Africa, the same thing. The people
yes,
are Charlie, moving their allegiance from Moscow to Peking.
Sam Jaffe?
I have something to add here. I think, Charlie, that it's not a question of believing in Peking's militant line that makes Indonesia's Communist Party side with the Chinese. I think it's fear. It's geographical fear of the Chinese and Chinese domination.
Well, it may be partly fear, Sam, but I just want to point this out, that the explosion of the Chinese nuclear bomb had a curious reaction in Asia. In Thailand, for instance, which is considered pro-Western and certainly has accepted a lot of our aid and is not part of the communist bloc, the people were rather pleased that the Chinese were able to set it off because finally the Asians had been able to do something, even though these were Chinese communists. And this is more of an Asian thing than it really is a matter of communists or who's really doing it.
Well, you don't think that's going to swing these people over to the Communist Party because the Chinese communists exploded a bomb.
An awful lot of people respect power, despite how the power comes about.
But I can go back to the original point that Lou made about it being geographic. It is true that all of the Asian communist parties are lined up with Peking. All the European communist parties, with the exception of Albania, are lined up with Moscow. And then you have strange things like New Zealand, of all places, the communist party there backing Peking. Cuba, in our backyard, doesn't seem to know what it's doing or where it's going. Sitting on the fence still.
Well, I think it's true that there's a tremendous Chinese influence in all communist parties. In Italy, although it's very minor and nothing to contend with at this point, there is a Chinese wing of the Italian Communist Party. Lou, is this also true in France?
Yes, yes indeed.
Russell Jones, you have mentioned before sitting on a fence. You've been sitting on a fence in Berlin, that wall that divides East and West Germany. Do you think there'll ever be any reunification worked out in the near future of the two Germanys?
In the near future, no. I think that Germany must be reunified sometime. You cannot keep this huge nation, 70-odd million people, separated. It's the Germans are much too dynamic, much too vital, much too talented. They must be reunified. But this is not going to happen. Next year, I wouldn't guarantee that it's going to happen in our lifetimes.
Nobody really wants it.
The Russians certainly don't want it.
The Germans want it.
Don, as far as the Soviets are concerned, I think next to the Chinese problem, the German problem is the greatest. They're scared stiff of the Germans. That land was wiped out, literally wiped out during the war. Villages were burned. Whole forests were burned down so that they couldn't rebuild. These people hate the Germans with a passion, the Russians.
And I think this is one of the factors that contributes to the Soviets' continued hold on countries such as Poland and Czechoslovakia, those two primarily, the other satellites to a lesser degree. The Poles hate both the Russians and the Germans, but they're much more afraid of the Germans. The same thing with the Czechs. The idea of another great, powerful Germany that might go in Hitler's path is unthinkable for these people.
And this, in a funny way, is how the United States, I think, personally, has contributed to de Gaulle's new prestige in Europe, because de Gaulle has been saying quietly in all the European capitals, look what the United States wants to do. They want to give the Germans a finger near the nuclear trigger, and everybody doesn't like that. And this has played really into de Gaulle's hands.
Don, looking back a little, I think it's a sorry commentary on our statesmanship since World War II that we've had to go into all these divisions. Every time we've had one, Germany, Korea, Vietnam, and even India and Pakistan, they've turned out to be trouble spots. And these are the places that are the potential war areas right now.
Let's see if we can make a quick roundup and a summary of the forecast of the future. What's going to happen in 1965? Charlie Arno, what's your observation for Vietnam?
Vietnam, I say it's 50-50 we may have to pull out. And if not, I don't foresee any victory. We're just going to keep on losing slower as we are now. I do foresee a closer threat of war between the United States and Red China, the possibility even of a clash breaking out between ourselves and the Chinese Reds in 1965.
Sam Jaffe, the Moscow forecast.
Well, I foresee better, much improved Soviet-American relations. I think the Chinese problem will continue, the ones that the Russians have now. I don't see any possibility of a reconciliation. And I see the new leaders working very hard to try to improve Russia's economic situation and helping the people out.
Bill Sheehan, what's the view from the Tower of London?
Well, the odds are there'll be an election in Britain in 1965, and I would guess it will be in the spring and that the Labour Party will win it with a better majority than they did the last one. But the most important question facing the British is, what about the pound sterling? Will they have to devalue? And if they do, it'll be a development that'll hit the United States right in the old breadbasket, because our fortunes are intertwined economically, and we should be watching here with interest to see whether the British can modernize their industry and increase their exports and get off and start to run in this highly competitive economic world.
What do you see from the Eiffel Tower, Luciaffi?
Well, I do not see General de Gaulle giving a barbecue for President Johnson when he comes to Paris. I see him giving a very, very nice French meal with the best French wines. I see a bettering of relations between the United States and France, but that will be agreement to disagree, and I don't think President Johnson is going to convince General de Gaulle of anything. If anything happens, it might be the contrary.
Looking both sides of the Berlin Wall, what do you see in Germany, Russell Jones?
I see a continuation of the détente between the Soviet Union and the United States, meaning specifically that there will be no trouble in Berlin, there will not be a blockade of the Autobahn, or violent incidents on the wall, or interference in the air corridors. On relations between West Germany and the United States, I think they will continue as they are, quite good, very close cooperation. On the other hand, I think that the West Germans are already out of love with de Gaulle, and this romance, if there's any left at all, will be much cooler in the coming year.
And Sidney Lazard, what are your observations after talking with the pigeons in St. Peter's Square?
Well, I foresee that next year we're going to have a lot of political activity in Rome. I think that the center-left idea, the center-left government headed by Premier Moro, will probably fall. I think there'll be a big scramble for power between the communists and the other left-wing parties and the extreme right-wing parties who would like to see the government get off the center-left course. I think there is likely to be a continuation of the deterioration of the economic situation with all its political implications, and I think that Italy in the coming year might very well become much more of a concern to the United States and to its allies than it's been in the past.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. We'll watch your observations in the calendar of the coming year.
You have been listening to ABC Correspondents at Home, a roundtable discussion with ABC correspondents from the news capitals of the world, offering their views of the year ahead on the international scene. The anchorman for tonight's program has been Don Gardner. The program was produced by Ken Scott.
Happy holidays from the ABC Radio Network.